This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. This is the podcast that's designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks so much for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of January 19th, 2026. It's been a year this week since President Trump took office and issued a slew of day one executive orders on everything from asylum to birthright citizenship. For the first of a two-part series, Elisa Resnick brings us to Tucson, where communities say deportation threats are worse than ever.
Maria Dori has navigated immigration enforcement threats all her life. Her parents brought her to the U.S. from Mexico when she was 3 years old. She's undocumented and grew up in Tucson in the midst of SB 1070, the now defunct Arizona law that gave local police the ability to make immigration-related arrests.
At least back then, it felt like, okay, they took my mom and dad, but we were able to see them the next week. Now it's like they took my mom and dad and I don't know where they're at.
Dori's in her 20s, has no criminal record, and over the years, she's applied for protection from deportation through DACA and a short-lived Biden-era program for undocumented spouses of U.S. citizens. Nothing's worked out so far. That makes her feel especially vulnerable now.
It's just because now it feels more like kidnapping. It feels like more people are getting taken from just doing everyday activities.
That worry bears out in the data. A record high of more than 68,000 people were being held in ICE detention facilities by the end of 2025, according to federal immigration figures. More than 70% of those detained have no criminal convictions.
Now, this is a very visible, really public effort because it's happening in daylight and it's happening in the suburbs where people live at their workplaces.
Kathleen Bush Joseph is a researcher with the Migration Policy Institute.
The biggest change that we've seen under this administration is the in-community arrests.
Bush Joseph says past immigration enforcement has focused on migrants at the border and people further inside the U.S. with a criminal record. But far fewer people are at the border now, meaning there are far fewer border crossers to arrest. Last year, arrests averaged just over 7,000 a month, the lowest rate since the 1970s. Meanwhile, Bush Joseph says the Trump administration has asserted that all immigrants, even those with temporary legal status, could be deported. And Congress has approved a supersized budget of $170 billion for immigration and border enforcement.
They've taken away that prioritization of people with criminal records, and instead, essentially everyone is fair game now.
The Trump administration says it deported some 622,000 people last year and claims 1.9 million have self-deported. Without detailed data to support those figures, Bush Joseph says it's hard to identify definitive patterns. But one thing is clear. More and more people are being detained far beyond the border. Tucson Vice Mayor Len Santa Cruz says that's a visible change in her community, where city leaders are hearing from community members every day with questions and fears about ramped up immigration enforcement.
We're continuously having to pivot, dealing with this, you know, immigration enforcement to create a theater, right? This political theater.
City leaders are looking for ways to limit ICE's use of city property for immigration enforcement, and Tucson police are already not authorized to act as immigration officers alongside ICE. Still, Santa Cruz says the onslaught of immigration enforcement carried out by masked, unidentified officers is eroding trust.
That's really unfortunate because this is a moment where we should be leaning into each other.
This month, city leaders also created a landing page to connect families with links to legal aid and instructions for planning in the event of someone getting detained. That's a discussion Maria Dori, the undocumented Tucsonan, has been trying to figure out how to have with her family.
It feels like the conversation of death. Like if my mom dies, who will become in charge?
Before Trump took office for a second time, her parents were deciding who would take care of her three younger siblings, who are U.S. citizens, if they were arrested. Seeing the reality now, she says, those conversations have become harder to face.
I'm like, okay, so plan B. So what if this happens? My mom like immediately tries to shut it down. And she's like, let's not talk about that right now.
Dory says she's also made changes. These days, she doesn't go to her sister's basketball games as much anymore because she's worried about getting detained. But she says being deported isn't what scares her the most. It's the worry that if she's detained, she won't be found. Alisa Resnick, KJZZ News, Tucson.
The full series on how a year under Trump has had an impact on both sides of the border is at kjzz.org. In education news, President Trump's administration on Wednesday dropped an effort to defund schools that teach diversity, equity, and inclusion. Cameron Sanchez reports the legal move undermines a top Arizona official's threats to schools.
1 year ago, Trump issued an executive order pledging to defund any schools teaching DEI, but a federal judge blocked that order in August. The Trump administration was seeking an appeal until this week. Arizona GOP Superintendent Tom Horn made defunding schools a central threat in his annual address to lawmakers on Tuesday. Horn said hundreds of millions of dollars are at risk unless Arizona reviews its teaching standards to eradicate any DEI language. He told lawmakers he was prepared to cut funding because he agrees with the Trump administration that DEI is wrong. Cameron Sanchez, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening.
Rio Salado College is hosting the Dash with Rio 5K and 10K Run Walk in Tempe on Saturday, April 18th. This community event welcomes runners and walkers of all levels with early bird registration for a limited time. Details at dashwithrio.com.
In politics news, here's Gabriel Piacerazio.
A bipartisan bill signed into law last year is now giving Native Americans residing in Arizona the option to update their state-issued identification to show off their tribal affiliation. It comes at a time when indigenous peoples are being swept up in immigration raids, including Peter Yazzie, a Navajo man recently detained by ICE agents in Peoria. This new marker is akin to getting an organ donor or veteran insignia on any form of ID, including a driver's license. To do so, applicants need to prove that they're enrolled in a tribe by submitting a CIB or Certificate of Indian Blood. And so far, the Arizona Department of Transportation has gotten more than 1,600 requests for the designation. That idea of streamlining legal documents came from Navajo Democratic State Representative Myron Sosie.
Instead of having to dig out all your cards to show that you are Native American.
And had nothing to do with ICE.
That wasn't the purpose. But I'm hearing from constituents saying I feel safer now.
And it's something Thomas Cody, executive director of the Navajo Nation's Division for Child and Family Services, is encouraging his Diné urban relatives to seek out.
It's unfortunate that we have to have on our ID that we're Native Americans. We shouldn't, but I'm glad that the state of Arizona, Governor Hobbs, is taking an extra step.
His deputy director, Solansta Jim, thinks this service is much needed, not just for Navajos living in the Grand Canyon state.
Because we are the largest Native American tribe, you'll find a Navajo tribal member anywhere in the United States.
That's why Sosi is working with neighboring Utah and New Mexico state lawmakers to adopt his legislation, aiming to help cover more of Indian country, including the rest of his sprawling 27,000 square mile reservation. Gabriel Piacerazio, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In Fronteras News. Remittances, or the money immigrants send back to their countries of origin, dropped to Mexico in 2025. From the Fronteras desk in Hermosillo, Nino Kravinsky has more.
Mexico's central bank says remittances to the country through November 2025 were around 5% lower than the previous year. The dip comes as U.S. immigration officials conduct raids across the United States, including at workplaces. Some immigrants in the U.S. have said they stay home to avoid being apprehended. Mexico received around $56 billion in remittances from January through November last year, less than the $60 billion it received in that period in 2024. That money is an important part of the economy. A report from the bank BBVA shows that more than a million people in Mexico are out of poverty thanks to remittances. Nina Kravinsky, KJZZ News, Hermosillo.
In science news, Arizona has had more than 200 measles cases since August. Most cases have been in a remote area of Mojave County, but in the past 3 weeks, Coconino, Pima, Maricopa, and Pinal counties have all reported their first cases. Catherine Davis-Young has more on the growing outbreak.
As the outbreak continues to grow, health officials are warning of potential measles exposure for anyone who visited the Hale Theater in Gilbert on several dates in early January, or anyone who visited two El Rio health clinics in Tucson in mid-January. Getting vaccinated is the best way Arizonans can protect themselves, says Dr. Richard Carmona, an advisor to the state health department. He says falling vaccination rates are to blame for the resurgence of measles.
It is really sad that we have been plagued with an epidemic of mis and disinformation, that people are uncertain of what to do and who to trust.
97% of cases in Arizona's outbreak have been among unvaccinated people. Catherine Davis Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In business news, Metro Phoenix is well known as simply the Valley. It's even a moniker the Phoenix Suns sometimes wear on their jerseys. But what's not so well known is what exactly is the Valley referring to. Through our Q&AZ reporting project, we've gotten questions about both the geography and the boundaries of this ubiquitous nickname. Jaslyn Gonzalez has some answers.
The standard definition of a valley is a low-lying area of land between mountains or hills, and Phoenix has an abundant supply of those. But so do other cities. It's a general enough description that other metro areas throughout the U.S. refer to themselves as the Valley, too. But here in Arizona, the reference generally means the greater Phoenix area. Duncan Schaefer is an ASU geography professor and Arizona resident of over 30 years. He tends to cringe at how general the term is.
We're really the Valley of the Sun. I mean, that's a promotional term that goes back to the 1930s. Technically, if you really want to be technical about it, we're the Salt River Valley.
According to the Arizona Republic, the term Valley of the Sun was originally coined in 1935 by a local advertising agency for the Phoenix Chamber of Commerce. But outside of slogans, Schaefer says the valley and its perimeter can be defined by key mountain ranges such as the
Estrellas, White Tanks, the Superstitions, the McDowells. Those are pretty definitive ranges in terms of defining where the valley is located.
However, Schaefer says mapping the valley from a geographic sense does become a little fuzzy. Heading north, the area blends into the Bradshaw Mountains of central Arizona, and it's not a perfect or complete ring in any direction. For example, South Mountain is a prominent southern boundary for portions of Phoenix, but isn't particularly visible to residents in, say, Gilbert. But Schaefer says the good thing about a term as loose as the valley is that people don't tend to set hard boundaries.
You're an outsider or you're an insider. You know, I don't think people ever really think in those terms.
And defining the valley is only one aspect of the regional geography. The area is distinctly divided into two subregions, the East and West Valleys. For Dave Wiley, a Tempe resident, there's a very clear line of demarcation.
If it's west of 17, then it's West Valley. If it's east, then I guess it's East Valley.
Some of the East Valley's biggest municipalities include Mesa, Chandler, Gilbert, Tempe, and Queen Creek. The West Valley lays claim to Avondale, Goodyear, Peoria, and Surprise. But Wiley says wherever people may draw the line, they tend to identify with one side or the other with no hesitation.
I think people definitely define a difference without a doubt, like in their head. Like they would say, I am East Valley or I am West Valley.
Wiley says he doesn't subscribe to that same belief and just views it all as the Phoenix metro area. But where exactly the outer limits of the valley extend to and where exactly East is divided from West will probably depend on who you ask. Jaslyn Gonzalez, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And if you've got a question about Arizona or the Valley, you can submit it at qaz.kjzz.org. And finally, from KJZZ's The Show. As FEMA rejected the Town of Globe's request for help after floods, co-host Lauren Gilger has this conversation with the mayor about what to do now.
Now, the state is appealing that decision. A coalition of Republican congressmen penned a letter urging FEMA to reconsider, and Governor Katie Hobbs spoke out against FEMA's denial in her State of the State address last week.
Blood, sweat, and tears went into building these livelihoods. How can our federal government turn its back on Arizonans who are simply trying to get back on their feet?
For his part, Mayor Gameros told me they'll be in a tough spot without the federal dollars. The city of about 7,000 people was hit with more than 2 inches of rain in 24 hours on September 27th, flooding creeks and roads and washing through downtown businesses and homes. 3 people died. I spoke with the mayor yesterday more about it, and he told me about the day the flooding hit. It had been raining for a few days, which wasn't out of the ordinary, and he had driven through downtown Globe just before it turned into a river.
And it was packed. I mean, the restaurants were full. There was people in the bars, people in the downtown area. And that was about 6 o'clock. I got home probably about 30, 40 minutes later. I got a call and asked if I was watching social media, and I said, no, I wasn't. And I got on social media, and I saw cars and propane tanks and just like a river flowing. I thought it was another state. And they advised me, no, that is downtown Globe.
He told me it happened faster than anyone could have predicted.
Yeah, it was like 30, 40 minutes. There was no warning. We had rain. You know, I live about 2 miles from the downtown area.
Sure.
So I immediately headed that way. There was roadblocks, obviously, because the water was still flowing. Once the water receded, I was able to drive towards the downtown area. About a mile away when I approached the entrance to it, It was just heart-wrenching. It was there was cars everywhere. There's debris on the road. There was propane tanks. We have a large courtesy Ford facility before you enter Globe, and I noted that all the new cars are on the that used to be in the parking lot were gone.
Wow.
They were in the parking lot next to it in Circle K. They were down the road. So as it turned down into the downtown area, into the north side of Globe, that's where it hit the hardest. It was just to see the front of these buildings, these businesses were just ripped out.
Wow.
And the contents were all spread all over the roadway or the street and everything. It was just devastating. It was, you know, just to see all the work and everything that had been done, not only by these business people, by our community, by our staff, our council to build our community. It was horrendous. What had happened, the water had overflowed, ran through the back of the buildings, ripped through the front out into the roadway.
So, I mean, this was all of the sudden, it sounds like, and really devastating. There were some people who lost their lives in these floods.
Yes.
I mean, tell us about how these impacts have continued. Like, it's many months later now. What's it like there today in Globe?
Well, it's really, I'm really impressed with the resilience of our community. Not only our business community, but our residents. Our downtown area is open. We probably have all the businesses open except that maybe 3 or 4 that were before the flood. So over close to 30 businesses have opened back up that were affected in some way. The cleanup was amazing. Once we opened up on that Sunday around noon, we had hundreds of people show up with shovels and rakes and brooms, and we had heavy equipment down there, people bringing their own heavy equipment. At one point, I think it was Monday or Tuesday, we had 3,000 volunteers come all over from all over the Southwest United States. They were in the community cleaning up.
That's amazing. So, I mean, a big effort by folks there and around the area. And it sounds like you've made a pretty good comeback, but there's, I'm sure, ongoing damage, it sounds like. What's that look like?
You bet. We still have ongoing damage to our residents. Obviously, there's some homes that are going to have to be condemned and have to be tore down. In our business district, who is affected, we have about 6 buildings that are still fenced off. They're going to have some extended engineering assessments in order to see if we're going to be able to save them. I believe probably around 3 of them we're going to have to take down in the end. But though just those areas are fenced off, everything else is cleaned up and opened up to business in the downtown area.
Okay. So you assessed the damage, you kind of came up with an estimate of how much it might add up to, and you submitted a claim to FEMA, and you were denied. I mean, what was your reaction?
Yeah, you know, in the initial, everything has to go through our county, Gila County, and then up to the state level, to the governor's office. Our initial assessment amount was about $33 million. That was early on. The final assessment report wasn't due till December 28th, but we received on December 23rd that the FEMA had denied our request before we even submitted our final one. And the final estimate is $96 million that we submitted on December 28th, which was the deadline date.
So that is a lot higher.
Oh yeah, three times higher. We have a lot of damage to our area in our infrastructure. You know, our sewer lines, water lines. We got roadways. We got a lot of things that we got to do, you know, and right now we're working off DEMA, which is state funding, mm-hmm. and that's a 75-25, meaning we get 75% reimbursement, but it still costs us 25%. So, you know, our staff has been amazing. They've been working nonstop, and it's almost 4 months later, and they're still working hard at different things. We have submitted through the NRCS, which is the National Resources Conservation Service. Mm-hmm. And our initial program is for $22 million, and that's part of that $98 million. But this is to take sediment out of our creeks. What we want to do is make sure that we build capacity in case it rains again, that we try and protect some of these businesses that have reinvested hundreds of thousands of dollars into their business to open again, and they're still in harm's way unless we build capacity in order to get the water through.
So as you said, you're appealing this decision by FEMA. You've submitted, you know, a new and more total estimate of the damages. I mean, you've got Congress members from Arizona advocating for you to the federal government. The governor denounced this denial in her State of the State address. You're yes. asking FEMA to come and see the damage and see what needs to be done.
You bet. And the governor is the one that has to provide the appeal. We provide all the support letters mm-hmm. To her. Also, another one, Congressman Eli Crane, which represents our area, has been really aggressive in trying to turn around the denial of FEMA. What we found out last night, we got a call last night that FEMA was heading to Globe again. So they are in Globe today, which may be a good sign. They're in here with state representatives and federal representatives to do reassessment. So we're hoping that's a good sign on our appeal.
So let me ask you, like, if you were not to receive these funds from the federal government, if the denial stands, like, what would that mean for Globe, for these people who have put a lot of money into repairing the damage and for the damage that still needs to be repaired?
Well, we're going to have to come up with ways to fund it. You know, the initial program through the NRCS that I just talked about is $22 million. But if we only have state funding, that's still $6 million to us, money that, you know, a rural community really doesn't have. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to come up with creative ways as how we're going to pay the pay for this this amount that the city has to pay. But our priority right now is to remove sediment and stabilize some walls along the creek's bed. What the federal designation will do, it'll open up programs for our residents and businesses in the form of buyback programs, like these people that lost their homes. It allows also for tax credits for business people. So it doesn't bring direct money to them, but it brings resources to them that are available that they can provide to them directly.
Okay. And it sounds like more news to come on this front. That is the mayor of Globe, Al Gameros, joining us. Thank you so much, Mayor, for coming on. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you very much, Elsa.
We also reached out to FEMA for a response to this story. We did not receive a response by this morning.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Katina Foundation, Basis Charter Schools, Palo Verde Generating Station, SRP, and the Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust. Thank you for listening and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian. This is KJZZ. Listen more, learn more online and on the KJZZ mobile app.